The business news of the nation, region, and the greater Des Moines Metro made possible through the support of Creamer Law Firm. Business law and estate planning, visit creamerlaw.com. And AARP of Iowa, real possibilities for our community and our citizens, no matter the age, aarp.org.
Welcome back to the Business News Hour. With us is Peter Zion, ladies and gentlemen. He is the author of the 2014 book called The Accidental Superpower. And he is really ingrained in this whole idea of geopolitical business and manufacturing and how energy plays a part in all this. This is going to be an interesting, fascinating conversation about our role in the global economy. Peter, welcome to the NewsHour. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here.
So tell us about this book title, The Accidental Superpower. What does that mean?
It means that the United States became the superpower not because of any particular plan or ideology or policy, but because we were almost fated. The United States has the most favorable geography in the world. The two things that you're looking for is you want a big chunk of land that is relatively isolated from everybody else, and the greater Midwest system is definitely that in spades. But the second piece you want is to be able to move around that land as cheaply and quickly as possible. It all comes down to water transport. Moving things by water is roughly 1/12 the cost of moving them on land. And the greater Mississippi system by itself is about 12,000 miles of interconnected, naturally occurring, navigable waterway. That's more than the internal transport system of the rest of the planet put together. And it's directly overlaid on the most productive arable land on the world. That doesn't happen anywhere else. And so no matter who was in charge, we were destined to be the most powerful country in the world.
That's an interesting thought. And then, of course, on the back of that was this, when Abraham Lincoln and the rail system that went across the continent, and then double that with the Eisenhower administration with the superhighways that he started, the interstate system. Really incredible opportunities to move goods and services all across. But to your point about the waterways, one of the emerging issues with that is the age of some of those navigable areas along the Mississippi and the Ohio and other places.
Absolutely. We've got a dock and lock system that in many places is almost a century old, but keep in mind what the cost would be for an upgrade. Mm-hmm. If you were to take out every dock, lock, and dam that helps with navigability on the entire American waterway network, you're talking about $150 billion, which sounds like a lot until you realize that we spend that much on the interstate highway every year, and you only have to do this once.
Right. And what would an upgrade of those waterways, what would that mean to commerce?
Well, there are two things you would probably want to do. One is the technological upgrade. We've got locks that are using the best technology that was available in 1905. It's probably time to upgrade that a touch. Second, there's a policy issue. There's a law in place called the Jones Act.
Correct.
Which makes it that any product that is shipped from any two American ports to each other has to be on a boat that is American-built, American-captained, American-owned, and 75% American-crewed. If you can loosen that up, you would see the cost of water transport in the United States probably drop by about 75%.
And there's an act that really most people didn't know about up until maybe 3 weeks ago with the Jones Act in Puerto Rico.
Yes, it definitely popped up with the Puerto Rico situation,
yes. Peter Zion, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about geopolitics. You know, reframing the future is one of the things that you talk about in your new book, The Absent Superpower, The Shale Revolution. This is interesting. You talk about geography, demography, and energy. How do those three things coalesce?
Well, let's start with geography. The United States has the best geography in the world.
You mentioned that.
And
yes.
The reason why the United States was the industrial superpower before World War II was because of that geography. With World War II, we changed the way that the world worked. We basically went out, established a free trade order in order to rustle up an alliance to contain and ultimately defeat the Soviets. But we never really updated our foreign policy when we won. So we've been on strategic coasting since 1992. So say what you will about Donald Trump, he's got a point that our foreign policy needs an update. That's piece one. And that policy has allowed everyone else in the world to be successful because all of a sudden we brought stability and safety to places that had never had it. So China became an industrial power. That's piece one. Piece two is demography. In a normal system, you've got more people who are in their 20s than in their 30s than they're in their 40s than
unfortunately.
Their 50s. Well, that's how it should be.
Yeah. Right.
In most of the world, it's now the opposite. The big urban push that we saw in most of the world after World War II means that in most countries, there's now more people in their 50s than their 40s and their 30s. So they've got people who add value and can build things very well, but not a lot of people who can consume. The United States still has a pretty normal demographic structure. So we're the only advanced country of size that actually can consume most of what we produce. So we don't need an export-led system. Everyone else does. Everyone else is dependent upon the American-led global order, except us. So if we back away from that system, everyone else has to find a completely new way to function in their societies and their economies. We do not. So we hold all the cards in the global relationship. And then the final piece is the shale revolution. The very short version is that Canada and the United States became net oil exporters as a unit.
Correct.
At the tail end of 2017. And the break-even cost for producing crude in the United States isn't just below the global average now. We're down to just over $40 a barrel. So we've achieved energy independence. The last of the ties that bind us to the broader system just broke.
Hmm. And those three issues really create an island with regard to the United States and Canada, yes?
United States, Canada, and to a lesser degree, Mexico.
Mexico.
Yeah, I would. The NAFTA powers are definitely tightly integrated, and that's definitely the future of the United States one way or the other.
One of the things in your book that you talk about is the instability or the and expense of wind power. And wind power here in Iowa is about 30% of our electrical generating opportunity. Talk to us a little bit about wind power and as we look at energy future.
Wind is not for everyone. There aren't a lot of places where the wind blows strong and reliable, reliable being the key thing. Iowa is an exception to the rule. The Great Plains, as a rule, are an exception to the rule. But as the technology evolves, it's getting better. And it's not just that the turbines are becoming more efficient and easier to service. It's the new type of turbines, instead of being 30 meters tall, are 70 meters tall. So you're talking about a 240-foot tall tower. Yeah. With that, you can top stronger and more reliable wind currents. And then you can start talking about wind becoming not just a complement to your power system, but your primary input. You're still going to need a backup plan for when the wind doesn't blow, because even these more new currents aren't perfect. But it's a much different sort of system. You just have to make sure that your complement power can be spun up relatively quickly. The best one out there is natural gas. And one of the side effects of the shale oil industry is that the United States now produces more waste product natural gas that is sold into the system at zero than anywhere else in the world, which means that Iowa, as it completes the switchover from almost exclusively coal to a wind natural gas mix, doesn't just get greener power, it gets cheaper power.
And that's one of the real draws for so many of these data farms that are taking a look at Iowa. Not only does Iowa pretty much disaster-proof when it comes to earthquakes and those types of things, but also we've got the land in which to do it, and secondarily, we have cheap power.
The only thing that I would say that is holding Iowa back on that regard is the specific type of niche skilled labor. But considering that the Iowa educational system with baseline is higher than anywhere else in the country, that's not something I lose a lot of sleep over.
I saw something in your book I hadn't thought about in years, and that is a conversation about Bretton Woods. I thought this was really interesting. Explain what Bretton Woods was and is.
So when people think about Bretton Woods, they think about the gold standard, they think about the IMF, and it's not that that's wrong, but that's really wasn't the point of the agreement.
Right.
Before World War II, things functioned differently. You didn't trade with people. You kept all your trade in-house because you never knew when someone's military conflict was going to sabotage whatever resource or market or trade route that you thought was important. So if you saw something you wanted, you went out and you took it, you colonized, you expanded into empire.
Right.
And you didn't trade with other empires if you could help it. Well, those empires competed for everything. Those competitions turned into World War II, and that brought the whole system crashing down. At the end of World War II, the Americans brought their allies together at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and laid out a new global architecture. For the first time, because this was the first true global order, the United States military would provide global security It would open its market, the only one to survive the war, and it would patrol the global ocean so that anyone could access any resource at any time to make any product that they could then ship anywhere. This was new. This had never happened before. But we didn't do it for economic reasons. We did it for security reasons. Because everybody who was represented was an ally, we were subsidizing a new alliance to fight and contain the Soviets. And it worked really well.
Until
we won. And the problem we had in 1992 is that the president, Bush Sr., who was putting together a replacement plan for Bretton Woods, got voted out of office. And his three successors, four now, have had no interest in updating Bretton Woods. So political support for global trade has obviously collapsed. Just remember that for the Americans, trade has never been about the economics. It's been about security. It's been about subsidizing the rest of the world. There's a reason why everyone's annoyed with it now. The question now is how fast we move away from it, and do we do something that shoots ourselves in the foot in the meantime? If we back away from the global system, that's more of a problem for the globe than us. But that doesn't mean that we don't have economic relationships that are probably worth a closer look, NAFTA being the top of the list.
You indicate in the book, we were talking about absent superpower, you indicate in the book that Americans believe things will always get better next year. And we have to have a panic from time to time. And we're very panic prone in this nation. Explain that.
It all comes down to what our formative cultural experience was. For the French, it's managing lots of different risks. For the Russians, it's the Mongol occupation. For us, it's the pioneer era. Because for the price of a Hyundai car today, if you were back in the early 1800s, you could load up the family into a Conestoga wagon, set out west, start producing grain in eastern Iowa, export that grain down the Mississippi almost free of charge to New Orleans and the wider world, and start earning hard currency, you know, with the six-month commitment. It was unheard of, and it lasted for 150 years. Mm. It's been the greatest cultural and economic expansion in history. That's our normal. That's not normal. The rest of the world is a relatively harsh place where survival is difficult, where economic growth can be hard to come by. So for the Americans, we're convinced from our pioneer experience that things can, will, should, are ordained by God to get better every single year. And when they don't, we kind of lose our minds. So some quick examples. Vietnam. We lost a post-colonial war to a rice producer. And despite the fact that we were the world's largest rice exporter at the time, and it wasn't our colony, we drew back, turned inward, put through something called the Revolution in Military Affairs, where we merged military technology and information technology, which has given us everything from cell phones and satellite communications to cruise missiles. Our overreaction to the Vietnam War is what shaped everything about power projection today. The 1980s oil embargoes are another good example.
Right.
We became convinced that the end was nigh and that the Saudis would completely control us in the future. As a result, we went through and basically took direct control of every trade artery in the planet and put into place the sort of activities that led to the energy and shale revolutions of the last 15 years, which have made the United States de facto energy independent. When we get poked, we lose our minds because we don't have any sense of context. And so we overreact, but we overreact with the power of a continent and the power of a superpower. And that redefines the global structures for the next generation.
How did September 11th put a panic into us, and what changed?
That's a great example. I mean, it was a horrible day. 3,000 dead, the largest number of people killed, civilians killed in the United States in its history. We now have permanent military forces on either side of every trade and energy artery on the planet. We have the ability to sever anyone's connection to anything else in the world at a moment's notice. And we have forced some of our allies to house some of the sharper ends of American power. All as a reaction to something that was a horrible day, but wasn't actually life-threatening to the United States. I mean, this is a country of 320 million people. The damage done on 9/11 was significant, but it's nothing compared to that other countries suffer on a regular basis.
We're talking with Peter Zion, ladies and gentlemen, the absent superpower, geopolitics in our world today. One of the things that you write in the book, you're talking about oil and where the oil reserves are, where shale oil reserves are, and we look at some really troubled nations out there where these oil deposits are. Places like Nigeria and Angola and Libya, Indonesia, Venezuela. Yikes. We can't bet a whole lot on that, can we?
No, and our foreign policy until roughly 2007 was based on how do we step back from the world but still maintain energy flow. So the United States had to have a forward position in the Middle East. We had to have diplomatic relations with Venezuela. Then came the shale revolution. And there are a couple aspects to the shale revolution that are kind of fun. First of all is that unique among all of the world's shale resources, ours are actually relatively close to population centers. So building the infrastructure to service the fields and link those fields to power plants and petrochemical refineries, that's really easily done here. It would cost at least a factor of five more in any other country. Second, because shale is trapped, shale energy is trapped within the rock formation almost at the moment that it becomes a petrocarbon, it doesn't have a chance to percolate through like other oil does. So, for example, in Venezuela, the oil kind of seeps through the ground until it reaches a cap rock that it can't pass through, and along the way it picks up lots of mercury and sulfur. So you get this thick, gooey material. It's about the consistency of toothpaste. That's about 3% sulfur. And you have to refine that oil before you can put it into a normal refinery. And that multi-step process adds a lot of cost. Well, the shale crude, because it never percolated through anything, is pure. In industry terms, it's not viscous and it has a very high gravity. Sulfur in the shale fields is usually less than 0.1%. So you can basically take it out of the ground, take it to a refinery, wave a white chicken over it, and you get gasoline. It's the easiest crude to refine in the world. So we've got this great proximity, and then we get this great end product, and now the United States is the world's, not just the world's largest refiner, but we're the world's largest exporter of not just refined products like diesel and gasoline and jet fuel, but of also of all the daughter products that you can make from oil and natural gas. And we've got enough to last at least another 140 years.
It's amazing stuff. When we take a look at shale oil production, that has some negativity attached to it as well. We're talking about fracking opportunities, instability of the geography, the kinds of things that we, even earthquakes have now been blamed in Oklahoma on potential messing up of the geography. Is that true?
Well, let me start with the basics here. I'm a green. I try to reduce my carbon footprint whenever I can, and yet I'm very pro-shale. The reason is the output of the shale fields is much cleaner than conventional energy production, and it's a lot more reliable than alternatives are at this point. The natural gas that comes out as a waste product in particular is very attractive because it's allowing us to completely displace diesel, gasoline, and coal from the fuel mix. That alone is dropping our carbon footprint by about 20%. And that's what's happened already. We're probably going to drop by another 20% over the next 10 years as this transformation completes. When it comes to side effects of the production itself, it's not that it's a non-issue, but it's not as big as most people think. The Obama administration did a six-year study on the impact of drinking water from the shale fields, and they basically came away with that there isn't one. And if you were going to have an EPA that was going to say something bad about fossil fuels, it was going to happen under the Obama administration. That's one of the reasons why the report was delayed until after the final by-elections, because he didn't want it to shape his political outcomes. But eventually it was released, and now we've got the data. It just doesn't support penetration of the water table. Keep in mind that most shale fracking is at least a mile down, most of it 2 miles, and the deepest water table in the country is only about 1,800 feet down. Most water table is less than 300 feet from the surface. So as long as the well is completed correctly, and that requires a concrete cap for the last couple hundred feet, the chances of migration of gas or fluids into the water table is negligible. Second, the frack fluids themselves are moving in a non-toxic direction. In fact, Halliburton, of all companies, is putting out a product that is made entirely out of products that are sourced from the food industry. So I'm not suggesting that you put this stuff on your salad. It tastes crappy, but I have tasted it. It's not toxic. It's not bad. And then third and finally, the earthquake issue. That is real, but it's not from the fracking. When you do a frack job, you pump roughly 2 to 20 million gallons of water down into a formation. You make the cracks open, you pump them full of sand, and then you suck the water back out.
Right.
You don't leave it there, and then you reuse the water for the next well. The earthquakes don't come from that because you ultimately haven't changed much of the underlying geology. What happens, though, is once you've done 10, 20, 100, 1,000, 10,000 wells, you have all this wastewater. And so you have to find a way to get rid of it. You're not going to dump it on the surface. So what they do is they drill a disposal well that goes at least 2 miles, sometimes more, down. And then they pump not millions of gallons, but billions of gallons of wastewater into the formation, and they leave it. And that causes buckling. And we know buckling is earthquakes.
Right.
So the smart money in the industry right now is finding ways to not just do with less water, which we're probably per barrel of oil we produce, we're already using less than a fifth of the water that we used 6 years ago. But then finding different ways to dispose of the water or reducing the waste. So one of the things they're trying in Oklahoma is basically running it through an evaporator so that most of the water doesn't even have to be injected because it's been, you know, it's out in the atmosphere then. And then they get more of a thicker concentrate and they dispose of that. But that is definitely a real issue that the industry is working overtime to try to solve.
Peter Zion, ladies and gentlemen, what an interesting conversation. What is it, and final question, Peter, what is it that most people do not understand about geopolitics and business?
Most people don't realize that the reason that we're having this hollowing out, or we have had this hollowing out in manufacturing, is because of American security policy. We have deliberately made the world as safe as possible, and that means that the natural advantages that the United States has, particularly the greater Midwest and the river system, have been muted as all of a sudden we have created our own competitors. So as the United States steps back from being the global policeman and the world drops back into a chaos that is honestly a little bit more historically normal, the country that will benefit the most from the diminishment of American security policies is the United States. And we're already seeing this huge reshoring as companies around the world are trying to get to positions where the inputs, the productive capacity, and the end consumer aren't just physically secure, they're co-located. And right now, that only happens in North America.
Fascinating. Peter Zion, thank you for spending some time with us, and thank you for being part of this whole Trust Belt tour. It must have been interesting for you to take this message to that large group of individuals who are sitting there going, wow, really?
Well, the crazy thing is, I'm actually from here. Marshalltown's home for
right,
me.
I know. Welcome home.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
How can people be so heartless? How can people be so cruel? Yeah, to be hard.